But today is VE Day. The war is
the
over.
The newly crowned queen waves from the balcony.
Eagle has landed. Apollo 11 has landed.
Tearing down the Berlin Wall.
Since 1929, the Monks Investment Trust's mission has been to help investors grow their wealth. We aim to do this today by taking a three-dimensional approach to growth. Cyclical growth, rapid growth, and steady growth.
The World Wide Web.
Wall Street is in turmoil as stocks crash.
The Monks Investment Trust, managed by Bailey Gifford. Capital at risk.
Hello, I'm joined today by Ben Whitmore, one of the UK's best-known value investors, who made waves 2 years ago with the announcement he and two other colleagues were leaving Jupiter to set up a boutique called Brickwood Asset Management. Ben, welcome to the studio.
Jeremy, thank you very much for inviting me.
So let's start on Brickwood. When was it that you, Dermot Murphy, and Claudia Ripley decided to leave Jupiter, and why?
So we thought there was an opportunity to create a fund management firm solely focused on value investing and focus all our energy and resources on just one style of investing and make that the best possible thing we could do in terms of not only investment performance but client service. And we felt, you know, after what had been a difficult period for value investing over the last, say, 10 years, that there was an opportunity there, and we felt that that was something that we could do.
So in a contrarian way, the timing was right?
I think so, slightly. I mean, you're never going to get the exact timing right, but broadly we felt that there was, you know, a real opportunity there.
Yeah. And talk to me about Kevin Murphy, who's Dermot's older brother, coming on board. Was that always part of the plan?
So Kevin and I worked together at Schroders, and we always felt that we wanted to create a place dedicated to value investing, and that it would be much stronger and better if we could also get another sort of like outstanding value investor. Kevin had co-led the Schroders value team, and so we felt that that would be make us much stronger and a really sort of powerful team going forward.
Yeah, and you must have wanted to do something differently to leave. I mean, you've talked about creating a space that's dedicated to value investing. So what is it you are doing differently today versus when you were at Jupiter or when Kevin was at Schroders?
So clearly, we're value investors, so that's not different at all.
Yeah.
And the investment process is very much the same. So those clearly core tenets are very, very similar. But of course, when you start up a new firm, you do get a chance to sort of make improvements, focus on things. And so one of the things that we've tried to do is really make sure the data behind the investment process all sits in one area, that it's not bitty, it's not broken up, that we've got a really powerful pool of data to assist our company analysis and portfolio construction. And that's one of the changes we've made. Yes, absolutely.
Okay. And why is it important to just do value investing? I mean, as part of a bigger group, were there distractions and pressures to change your stripes?
So I think it's not, it's really about just focusing the whole firm on one output, which is to try and be the best at value investing that we can. So if you have all the resources of the firm, thinking about how to make that better, I think it's really just the focus, and then you can design everything how you want it to be, and that focus, I think, gives you a real opportunity to keep improving.
Okay, and people say how hard it is to set up a boutique. I mean, has that been your own experience?
So really the setting up of the business was primarily led by our CEO Claudia Ripley and our head of operations, Lucy Wright. Mm-hmm. I think, clearly, if it's the first time you've done something, you haven't got anything to reference. But I think, you know, as expected, there are, you know, lots of sort of reasonably high hurdles in the sense that we're a regulated industry. We need to take that side very, very, very seriously. We wanted to be, if you like, institutional grade in terms of our systems and processes. We wanted to have the correct governance in place, so we've got a non-executive chair and a non-executive director. So I think we thought long and hard about making sure that everything that we did to set up the firm was at a very, very high level of quality. So I think that naturally means, you know, it's quite hard work, but really led by Claudia, our CEO. You know, I think it is hard work to do that, but at the same time, you know, if you're really passionate and you want to achieve it, it can be done.
Okay. And something I think that's been maybe very helpful for Brickwood is you've been able to bring over a couple of these segregated mandates, these separate accounts that you ran for big clients before. Was that essential to being able to do this?
Yeah, so we're very grateful that some of our clients that we've had for a long period have trusted us to carry on running their money. And I think, you know, having a balance of business between segregated mandates who can come over immediately and then launching to funds, I think that balance is, yes, it's incredibly helpful.
Yeah. And you told me that's helped you, you told me before, that's helped you kind of be profitable almost from day one.
So that a combination of those things helps you, yes, exactly, because you want to invest in the business and make sure that you're doing everything to the best possible way you can.
Yeah.
And so, yes, that is very helpful.
And at a personal level, I believe your parents set up a business. I think it was a brewery. So was there a sense you wanted to follow in their footsteps a bit?
Yeah, that's right. They did. That was a very long time ago in the mid 1970s.
Okay.
And I don't think I always assumed I'd do that. But I think really setting up a business is only possible if you work with a great team of people. And so the only way we were able to do it, because we'd forged such a strong team, and I think that is actually the really important thing.
Okay. And I suppose, you know, before we come to the more onto investments, you know, on the team, I mean, what's it like working with two brothers? Is that good fun?
Yeah, I've worked, Durbin and I have sat next to each other for over a decade, and I used to work with Kevin at Schroders. So I've worked with both of them through long periods of my career. And it's very, very nice working with, if you like, the three of us together. I think the key thing is we're all very passionate about value investing. And in terms of brothers working together, they're incredibly professional.
Right.
And so I don't think, you know, you'd naturally guess they are brothers if you were just listening in to like debates around stocks. It's done in, you know, such a very professional way. And although it's clearly of interest to quite a few people, it's not something that I've really given much thought to at all.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
You think about it.
It feels very natural. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Oh, okay, that's interesting. So, you know, coming more onto the investment side. There's been a lot of concern this year about AI disrupting business models, including lots of tech and software businesses. But in recent days, for example, even wealth management stocks, of which you own a couple, have been selling off after, I'll probably bungle the background, but I think a relatively unknown AI company released some tools which might help advisors personalize their investment strategies more easily. I mean, what do you make of some of that AI-driven sell-off we've seen in the market this year?
So clearly AI is going to cause quite a few changes to businesses and industries. Clearly we don't know the scale of the change yet, but it's fair to say the stock market is very nervous about the potential impact in certain industries. And it doesn't take much for those nerves to spread, because as you mentioned, quite often these might be startups with no customers, but as soon as anyone announces they have, if you like, an AI-enabled, whether it's software to disrupt the legal industry or software to disrupt price comparison or the advisor market, the stock market is very, very nervous indeed.
Yeah. And do you think it's right to be so nervous?
So I think any period of great change, when the stock market senses great change, clearly nervousness is the likely thing to happen. And for us as investors, clearly, we're trying to weigh up the balance of valuation versus risk always in all situations. I think, it, as you mentioned at the start, the one with the software companies, we haven't really had to think about those much because historically they've been on very high valuations. So as value investors, they've been out of our sort of like lens to look at. But clearly, with there have been some quite sharp falls over the last 3 to 6 months, those are beginning to come into some of our screens, in particular our Greenblatt screen. So I'm pretty sure we will end up looking at those in the next 3 to 6 months, yes.
That's interesting. I mean, you know, we mentioned wealth management as well. You do hold St. James's Place.
Yeah.
So what are your thoughts on that?
So I think where the stock market is most worried is if it thinks the existing business can be replaced by a new business. And I think the one area where AI might struggle, and clearly we're in the early foothills, is that there are certain subjects where humans very much want some personal advice and personal recommendations. And the relationships people have with their advisor are very strong. And if those advisors can use AI to help them, you know, deliver the advice at lower cost or better advice, I'm sure that will be adopted by wealth managers in general. But I think at the heart of it, the business exists because the clients trust the financial advisor to look after them and give the best possible advice. It strikes me it's quite a big jump to imagine that savers, pensioners, people coming up to retirement who are after all this advice are going to just use an AI tool to come up with the best advice for them. That seems to me quite a big jump.
Right.
Can you imagine wealth advisors using it to really help their clients? Yes, you can. But I think to imagine that an entire industry can just be bypassed, I think, and I could be proven wrong, but that seems quite a big leap to take.
Right. ChatGPT is not suddenly going to be Mrs. Miggins' advisor.
Yeah, well, I guess it's not so much ChatGPT, it's the sort of paid versions which are improving at such a rapid rate. But I think the human interface is so important.
Yeah.
I think in the UK we've had quite a lot of robo-advisors for quite a long period. And my understanding is those really haven't taken off. People don't tend to like that. On the other hand, we do have a lot of DIY platforms as well. Those have taken off. And so I think on the advice side that the robo-advice hasn't really taken off and that people do still really want that human interaction.
Okay. What one interesting trend in the UK at least, which you've touched on a little bit there, is some so-called quality stocks, which were once very highly valued franchises in some cases. Some of those have derated a lot. And I think some of those have become value stocks that you've started buying.
So I think someone once told me that the longer you spend investing, the more likely you are to see every stock on every valuation. So I think it's a cycle. If you take, for example, in the sort of 2020, 2021, there were some franchises which are high quality, which achieved exceptionally high valuations. And some of the trends in COVID were extrapolated. So, for example, if you take Diageo, the beer and spirits company, there was quite a lot of drinking at home. People were ordering spirits at home. The company was on an exceptionally high valuation. And as COVID went away and people got back to normal, there's been a whole series of destocking. There's some slight worries over what people call the Great Moderation. And that's led to a very, very sharp fall in the valuation applied to that company. And it's one of those that on our screens looks attractive. And so what we're really relying on for the screens is like an objective look at things. The screens just say, hey, have you noticed this company is now quite high up on the screens? Why don't you go and look at it? And I think that's the key thing for the screens. It's they're objective. And so 5 years ago, they were saying, have you, the banks are on 0.3 or 0.4 of tangible book value, please go and look at them. They weren't saying, look at Diageo, and I think. And now, five or six years later, they're saying, you need to go and have a look at this now.
Yeah. And do you think it's a kind of particular opportunity? Because some of these quality stocks, they, you know, the earnings are not volatile. They shouldn't be cyclical companies.
I think you've really got to assess everything on its own merits. I don't think you can make... it's difficult to make big generalizations.
Yeah.
But I think you've just got to go where the value exists and then look at each stock on a case-by-case basis.
Yeah. And you mentioned, you know, shares in some of the big UK banks, all of them really have been on this amazing and extending rally. You own Barclays, you own NatWest, I believe. I mean, have lots of the banks got too expensive, do you think?
Well, I think with a more normal interest rate environment, banks can earn now reasonable returns. So Lloyds and NatWest, which are sort of very focused UK mortgage current account operations, they're earning now 16, 17, 18% returns on equity and are trading at, you know, 1.6, 1.7, 1.8 times tangible book value. So it looks to me that the valuations look fair for those returns. It clearly, they're not staggeringly undervalued when, you know, 4 or 5 years ago they were trading at very big discounts to tangible book value. So it doesn't strike me that there's a huge opportunity there going forward. I think they're more fairly valued.
Okay, that makes sense. I mean, so on NatWest, there is this trend about UK banks going kind of back into wealth management or financial advice. What did you make of the announcement it's buying Evelyn Partners, one of the biggest wealth managers in the UK?
So I think more broadly, and this is not specific to NatWest,
okay,
is that M&A comes with risks. The price you pay for any asset, it might also tell you that the management don't think there's much growth left in the core franchise. So I think... notwithstanding the NatWest transaction,
okay,
more broadly, I'm a bit sceptical of M&A, just because historically the evidence shows that it doesn't work.
Okay, big promises but hard to deliver.
Yeah, and I think also just that, you know, you end up paying quite full prices. Now, NatWest is, the headline price looks quite high, but they think there's going to be a lot of cost savings, which brings down the price. It's not a huge amount in the context of NatWest as a bank. So those two things are probably in their favour. They have got an existing wealth management business, Coutts, so they understand the business. But I would say in general, we're sceptical of M&A.
All right. It's not related to the portfolio, but another one I've got to ask you about because it's topical today is the US asset manager Nuveen buying Schroders, your old employer. I mean, what do you think? Are you surprised?
So I think there has been quite a lot of consolidation in the asset management industry. I think that general trend is not a huge surprise. The specifics of any transaction are always surprising on the day. But I think the big picture, there has been a lot of consolidation in asset management, yeah.
So it's just a continuation of that trend. Okay. So coming on to you run at Brickwood both a UK Value Fund and a Global Value Fund. I mean, if we look at the top-down view of the UK Value Fund, at the end of last year, the UK was the biggest single country exposure. The US was not far behind, about 18% at the end of December, which is massively underweight versus the global benchmark. But I think that's where you've been finding more opportunities recently in the US. Is that correct?
Yes. On the Global Value Fund, which I co-manage with Dermot Murphy, we are beginning to see, and this is a sort of slight paradox, the US is the most highly valued major market in the world, but that's partly due to some of the very largest companies. But the bottom decile of valuations, given that most international markets have rallied quite strongly over the last 12 to 18 months, and unusually compared to international markets, value stocks in America have done very poorly in the last 18 months, carrying on that trend. that actually that bottom decile has got quite a lot of attractive valuations. So we are definitely seeing quite a lot of opportunities to look at there, yes, absolutely.
Okay. Can you give us a flavour of what sort of thing?
Yes, so for example, PayPal, the consumer branded checkout payment business, is trading on a 13% free cash flow yield with net cash. There are worries there. You can find the company that owns Tommy Hilfiger and Calvin Klein trading on an exceptionally low valuation. You can find a company called Dentsply Sirona, a dental stock, the dentist industry, trading on exceptionally low valuations. And you can find a range of companies on very low valuations. So whilst it's absolutely correct to say the market in aggregate is on a very, very high valuation, if you look under the bonnet in the bottom decile, you can actually find big international companies trading on absolute valuations that are very low and very and lower quite often than many of the international companies.
Yes. It'd be good to get a thought from you about Japan, which is the third biggest exposure in that global portfolio. What do you make about this sort of corporate governance revolution narrative we're seeing in Japan?
Yeah, so I think that is important. In particular, a lot of mid and small cap Japanese companies have hoarded cash and not had any focus on return on tangible equity. And so I think that discipline is a good discipline to try and force companies to think about getting returns and their valuations up to book value as a minimum, to think about capital allocation and returns. I do think that is a very good discipline here.
Okay. And so you're sort of actively hunting for those situations.
So we've got a variety of investments there. All of our companies in Japan have got exceptionally strong balance sheets. Some we think are way too overcapitalized, and we would like to see, you know, higher dividends, share buybacks, where that is the case, yes.
Okay. And more broadly, I mean, where else do you think has got too expensive in the market?
Well, I think when you look globally, there's such a variety to look at. We don't really tend to look for what is expensive. We tend to have our lens on what is very lowly valued.
Okay.
So that tends to be, you know, pretty broad. So at the moment, as I mentioned, there are big international companies in America which you can find at very low valuations. But at the same time, we found low valuations in Brazil, Hong Kong, Europe, Japan. So I think there's a real spread. And so globally, what that means is that if you think about the global index, the MSCI Equi World Index, it's dominated by America. And within that, it's dominated by 10, you know, enormous companies. And what that means is that's very concentrated. And what we're able to do, which is very different, is to have a portfolio that's very diversified in a true sense. So we don't have any sector or industry or geography dominating the portfolio. And that for us is much fundamentally much stronger.
Yeah. Okay. That kind of brings me on to something I wanted to ask you, which was, I mean, last decade was very tough for value investors, and there must have been points in the last 2 years where we've seen the sort of fever for the Magnificent Seven that must have been at least frustrating. I mean, have you ever had moments of doubt about the style, or at least, you know, made some tweaks to what you do?
So the philosophy, which really was first, if you like, codified or expanded on by Graham and Dodd nearly 100 years ago, has stood the test of time. But whenever you look at the breakdown of the excess returns from value investing, there are always difficult periods for it. And so you do know and understand there will be difficult periods. Clearly, when you're in one, it is, you know, it's harder. And clearly you need to have made sure that you explained all these issues to your clients. But I think whenever you sort of get worried or doubt it, the key thing really is to come back to the evidence of the philosophy and see that although there are always periods where it doesn't work, that over time it does. And the absolutely crucial thing is to keep on applying that philosophy, even at the times where you think, this, why is it the right time to do it? So right. I distinctly remember, you know, when COVID struck, we'd run the screens and, you know, the key thing, you know, we were looking at, should we look at Airbus? Should we look at Boeing? Should we look at booking.com? And I think it's the key thing is to make sure that you keep putting it into practice and that you don't panic, you don't decide to you know, do something different. That really would not be right. And I think just having that patience and discipline is very, very important.
Yeah. And it strikes me that as we've been talking, you know, often that if a stock is derated, there will often be many reasons. But often the simplest narrative, which you've mentioned lots of times, is about threat to the business model and doubts about the long-term business model. What are the keys for you then in kind of getting that confidence that something isn't a value trap?
Yeah, so you're absolutely right. Lowly valued stocks tend to have issues. It might be they're out of fashion with the market. There might be worries about the economic cycle, poor capital allocation, or like a worry about the business model, like can it exist in 5, 10, 15, 20 years' time? And I think really what we want to do is we want to look at the history of the company, understand what's going on. There's an enormous amount to read around the business, whether it's from the company itself, from competitors. And what we're really looking at is for companies where we just think the reasons that are more cyclical or just fashion related, rather than, if you like, the structural side. Now, clearly, for us as value investors, over the long haul, we're trying to push the odds slightly in our favour. That's the absolute crucial thing, and that your winners win more than your losers lose. And so we're just trying to move the odds in our favour. So we want companies that aren't the most levered, that they don't have the worst cash generation, that we think the reasons are temporary. They just might be an economic cycle. They might be a poor decision on capital allocation, which the market's punished the business for, but where we think that core franchise has durability. And that for us is the, if you like, the investment process, yes.
Okay. And I mean, something else I kind of wanted to circle back on was, we were speaking about AI earlier in the context of financial advice. I mean, what do you think the effect of AI will be on investment, how people actually invest? Is that something you have many thoughts on?
So I think clearly AI, and we're seeing that already, is able to do some of the tasks that you would have had to do before. So clearly the more non-value added tasks can be done elsewhere can assist you. But I think the judgment around each individual company, you know, still requires human judgment. Now, you might say that's self-serving because why would I say anything different? But I think, you know, what we've seen over time is, you know, when I started, you know, writing out paper trading forms, data stream was, there was one access shared by a whole group of people. There was one topic screen on a tele screen that had no functionality. And I think data has changed enormously over the last 30 years. And I think, you know, what we'll want to do is just harness the power to use data to help the investment process and philosophy. And then, you know, then you come back to making those judgments as to why is the franchise out of favor? Do we think it's an attractive investment opportunity? But I'm absolutely all up for using any forms of improvements to enhance the process, yes.
Yeah. And so your edge then remains human judgment and meeting with management?
I don't think it's meeting with management. I think it's just having the discipline to stick to things. Lots of people abandon things when things get tough, and you touched upon that earlier. And I think one of the edges is sticking to it, a constant drive to improve, and just repeating that. If there is an edge, I think it's that.
Okay. So, you know, finishing with a couple of broader questions, Ben. I mean, what's the vision for Brickworld? Where do you want the firm to be in 5 years' time?
I think, you know, all four of us, we just want to be admired for value investing and for clients to have had a good outcome when they've trusted us with their savings.
Yeah. Okay. It's as simple as that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. You know, no targets or that kind of thing.
No, you've got to, those are the two, I think, real key tenets.
Okay. This is 2 decades ago now, but there's a story that when you handed over the management of the Schroeder Recovery Fund, so you were leaving Schroeder's to Kevin Murphy and Nick Kirridge, you gave them some unusual investment advice, which was, one of them told me this, I can't remember which was, if you do not have one company going bust every year in this fund, you are not taking enough risk and you're not going to generate the performance. Is that still a philosophy that you worked in?
Well, I think that's, I can't exactly remember that, maybe my memory from 20 years
it
ago.
It might have been worked into a punchier statement over time.
I think it sounds like I was exaggerating that for effect, but I think that the real thing is if you are a value investor, you need to look at things that are deeply out of favour. And I think it's just sort of encouraging to look at things out of favour. Now, clearly that had a mandate to take a bit more risk in that regard. But I think really it's not those exact words, but really it's the principle that you need to be looking at things that are deeply out of favour.
Okay. Well, that seems a good note to finish on, Ben, given what you do. So, yeah, thanks very much for coming in today.
Thanks very much indeed.
But today is VE Day. The boys
the newly crowned queen waves from the Belt.
Eagle has landed. Apollo 11 has
tearing down the Berlin Wall.
Since 1929, the Monks Investment Trust's mission has been to help investors grow their wealth. We aim to do this today by taking a three-dimensional approach to growth. Cyclical growth, rapid growth, and steady growth.
The World Wide Web.
And Wall Street is in turmoil as stocks crash.
The Monks Investment Trust, managed by Bailey Gifford. Capital at risk.